obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, my name is Nancy. I'm a grateful alcoholic. And you are too, huh? You guys really act grateful. You've been acting grateful all weekend. It's really fun. I'm kind of excited about this meeting. I've been excited about it for a while, and I want to thank Dave for getting me here, and Mike for his help, and Carol for coming down. And it just it's been a this is really a very good roundup. It's really a lot of fun, and the speakers have been, you know, great. And so, now it's me. Oh, okay. But I don't judge, and so you shouldn't judge either. So, thank you very much for that. Boy, I wish we drank together. He just took great care of me, didn't he? That was nice.
Maybe we did.
Yeah. There's more possibilities in sobriety than you ever imagined, you know. Options. Hey, I know you. I've been a troubled person for most of my life, and by some standards. And I actually really loved drinking, and if I could still drink, surely I would, but I just really can't drink like I like to drink anymore. I've been sober since June 28th, 1976. And, you know, I was, thank you, but really, it's hardly my applause, that one. It's ours. And AA is big, and deep as anything I've ever encountered. And you know, one of the things that I was reminded of this morning, I was thinking, you know, I wasn't thinking about this talk, of course, I was thinking about something that I read that Bill Wilson said about conventions and conferences. When they first started having them, the alcoholics all worried, and they had meetings about whether or not this would be good for us. And you know, maybe conferences wouldn't be good for us. And, you know, we worry about everything, don't we? Everything. Two-hour meetings over Coke machines and everything. It's like, but they thought, but Bill said, with that wisdom that struck him so many times, he said that these conferences were vision stretchers, that we had to get away from our home groups and all, you know, get together like this and just see. Just lay eyes on each other and how good that is. And you know, I really, this weekend I ran into, for the first time, I actually ran into the guy that answered the phone at central office the second time I called that got me here. And he was a major teacher in my life. And in almost 34 years, I have never run into him again. Until today, and he lives right around here. But you know, go figure. You know, I don't even question these things anymore. What you know, what good is that, right? But this guy was my first teacher. He was so good because I had called AA one other time. I was just, you know, rooting around for someone to talk to, you know, and I called AA, and this woman answered who talked too much. You know, I mean, I'm on the phone and she's talking too much, you know. And I thought, oh, that's missionary work. I even met her for lunch once, and she had all this makeup on, you know, and she was just talking about herself endlessly. And I thought, what is this? And so, of course, I went a few more rounds with alcohol, got beat up pretty good. I had this black eye, I had a split lip. I was really fat from drinking. And you know, and I called AA again, and Joe answered the phone that morning. It was a Sunday morning, June 27th of 1976. And he answered the phone that morning, and he was like the perfect guy. You know, it's God's business, this whole thing. Because when it's your time, that perfect nut will be there for you. Have you ever noticed that? Because none of us is well. You know, we're all bent and have a little goofy thing. But just when the time is perfect, there is no computer program in the world that can engineer what God does with each one of our souls. And this guy was the right guy for me that morning. And all I remember from my kind of newcomer perspective, or not even newcomer, I mean, I was just wet. You know, I was always just wet. Even between drinks, I was just kind of wet. You know, booze poured out of my, it was summer, but I was just, booze was pouring out of my pores, even in air conditioning. I was always, you know, back when they passed the law for legal drunk being 0.8, I was living in Laguna Beach and was going to meetings with Patio. Many of you know Patio. And we heard this law had passed that morning. We went to the noon meeting. And we laughed and we laughed and we laughed. We said, we used to wake up 0.8. Really, really. So, but the morning I called Joe was a really bad morning. And I'm so excited. I don't know if he's around. Maybe he'll hear that I'm, is that, okay, hey, okay. Yay, Joe. This guy was so beautiful. Let me tell you what he did, because this is my first teacher in recovery. He listened to me, because I was just full of that, you know, my 0.8. I was full of that. So I was talking about Democrats and Irish people and the Catholic Church and my car and all the famous shoes I had thrown up on and, you know. And periodically, I would stop to take a breath, you know. And that's when Joe made his move. I'm telling you, he was touched by the Spirit because God knew what he had, was working with that morning. There's another broken performer who was going to come in. And Joe made his move. I'd take a talk and take a breath, and Joe would say, just clean, real clean, through the phone. He said, sounds like you need a meeting. And, you know, and I'm all wound up, so I got more to say. And finally, he got the last word, and I came to a meeting. You know why I came to the meeting? Let me tell you why I came to the meeting. Because he was so nice, and he was interested in me. And that other lady wasn't interested in me. She just had stories to talk about herself. He was interested in me, I thought, you know. He might have put the phone down, I don't know, and gone to the restroom. But I believed that he was interested in me. And so I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to show his boss that he was doing a good job on the phone. Praise God, really. So I get there, and he's all I remember about Joe from that day, and I've never seen him since until this weekend. I remember from that day is him sort of running after me down the street going, just give us 90 days. And I'm far too busy, you know, to do anything like that. So, but, you know, I've remembered you in many, many prayers and in many, every talk. You've been with me ever since. And because that was my first teacher. Of course, I got to the meeting, couldn't stand the meeting. I had a big black eye. Now, picture this. I know nothing about our world, absolutely nothing, and I'm not looking for our world. Do you hear that? Okay, Susan, you have to check. I'm not afraid to check anymore. My name is Nancy. What was I talking about? Do you remember what I was talking about? Oh, yeah. Oh, so he goes, yes. So, but I didn't want to, huh? Our world. Oh, yeah. Okay. I didn't know, you know, because now I'm so steeped in it, I forget, you know, but I really didn't have us clueless. So I show up for this meeting, which Joe had told me was at noon, which I thought was horribly early. And I didn't know anybody who got up at noon. Noon? God. And I had this black eye. I put a lot of makeup on my other eye because I was crazy and I was all wet and everything. But I knew I wasn't symmetrical. So I put a lot of makeup on the other eye, and then I would overdo it. So then I had to put a little makeup over here. Ow! And oh yeah, and I'm eyes, and I come down to this meeting eyes, you know. And I put on jeans that could have gone on their own if I'd given them directions and money. And I show up. And I don't know that I look like a walking 12-step call. You know, if I'd been wearing a sandwich board that said 12-step call here, sponsors are elbowing babies, go talk to her. You know, I didn't know that. But it seemed like the big Rush was on, like you recognize a rock star, I'm thinking. Because you, like, rushed me. Nobody has been glad to see me for months. And the big Rush is on, and I showed up, and I propped me up a little bit. I'm going, well, hey. But I was very uncomfortable, actually, with all, actually, because you were giving me your phone number. I didn't want your phone number. I just wanted your adoration. And but people were giving their phone numbers, and they had matching socks and, you know, current hairdos, and it was corny. It was corny. And it was like daylight, and they talked in full sentences. That was really disturbing. We torture new people with language, don't we? Man, all I spoke then was cool. The language of cool is four words. Three of them are wow. Then you got your other word. And that was my repertoire. So there you were, torturing me with all this speech was going on. And you know, in truth, I was pretty damaged and I really couldn't hear anything. So, but I left the meeting with the vision of the woman leading the meeting, which actually brought me back to AA. She was so happy. And she was so happy being here, doing what we do. And I feel that you know what I mean. There's some light that goes on in us when we're in the middle of the deal that, God, if we could bottle it, we'd make a fortune, right? But we can't bottle it because it's not for sale. But you can have it if you do what we do. And this lady was so beautiful. And it brought me back. I didn't hear anything about anything. Oh, well, I got scared out of here because I kind of came in hoping there was a formula for drinking. So what scared me out of here, and I heard it right away, we don't drink it at all. You all didn't drink at all. And you didn't use drugs. And by the way, I had quit smoking pot 3 weeks before that day. I keep wanting a chip for that. Nobody gives me recognition for that, you know. I remember quitting pot. I was seriously drunk, and I had that Hollywood box of pot. You know, and and this moment of clarity hit me. That's my problem. So I didn't get rid of it, but I knew it was my problem. Anyway, I left that meeting, and I left and with the vision of that woman. I also saw the seventh tradition basket making its way from the front of the room to the back of the room with all those dollar bills hanging off the edge. That was interesting. And I watched that go back, and I wondered who got all that money. And that was it for my first exposure. Hey, I went on, got another bottle, and it was just a midday on a Sunday afternoon in the Hollywood Hills in some guy's room up in the hills, and I'm drinking and talking, and something happened. Something happened down deep in me. It was really one of the worst moments ever when I knew that alcohol didn't work anymore. Oh, I remember, huh? Everybody's going, oh, I remember that. Oh, God. It's just, you can't get drunk. You're never going to be drunk like that again. And I don't know, it just was a knowing. And here's the real tragedy. I got up and I left a bottle, a big bottle of white wine for the afternoon, hardly dented, mostly full. And I left. I left the bottle there. Can we have a moment of silence for that? It's like, I think that's the worst part of my story.
Where's the bottle?
Gosh, that was sad. And I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous the next day, which was June 28, 1976. I wore a bikini to my first meeting. I didn't know if I needed a meeting or a tan, you know. And I might have overreacted the day before. But again, you know, all of my life before this program, I lived on Planet Nancy. Yeah. It's pretty funny. Selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of every single problem I think I have. And it always was. So I would live on, I had my own rules. I had my own agendas. And I was acting very flexible. I would just become whatever I thought was convenient at the time. So I didn't have anything. So I showed up at this church the day of my sobriety, the first day of my sobriety. I showed up at this church in a bikini. I got there early. It was one of those darn noon meetings. And I was up early because I had the physical allergy of alcoholism. And that physical allergy just takes over your body. And you just go crazy in increments. It's so cruel. But by this time, I didn't have breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and I didn't have to wake up and go to work. So I did whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted. So I actually ended up early at this noon meeting. It was like 10 o'clock. And it was Monday. It was the day the gardeners were there. So the gardeners had trimmed the church property. They had mowed the lawn and clipped the hedges. And I showed up in my bikini, and I'm still fat and sweaty. I still have a big black eye. I have a little dent in my lip. And I'm wearing my bikini, and I got sleepy, and I had this fancy foreign car, and I got out of my fancy foreign car, and I stretched out on the lawn, and I went to sleep for a while. And finally, 12:30 rolled around. I got up to my feet, went upstairs to the meeting, and filled that doorway, all big old sweaty me with my black eye, my bikini, and grass clippings from here to here. And sponsors started poking their babies, and they said, there's that 12-step call. And I didn't know. Everybody was so cheerful and glad to see me. And, you know, I mean, it was a tsunami of welcome. You know, it was almost not up to the task because, you know, I knew you guys needed some straightening out. You had a pretty corny book, and there was too much corn here, too much. You were focusing too much on me. I wanted to have you cut that back a little bit, so... What did I know? You know, but it all was part of the plan. You know, I came to a really broken person. By the time I got here, everything that I used to fix me with didn't work anymore, and that includes music. It includes the one thing in my life that I loved more than alcohol was music. I loved music so much. I was passionate about it, and it had been my comfort. It was my joy, and I lost it to drinking. And that is one definition of the bottom, when you lose the only thing you love as much as alcohol, or you're just about to. And that's what happened to me in those days. So I came from an Irish Catholic family, and my mom and dad drove out to California from Pennsylvania on the wings of the American dream. That my dad was a hotshot writer on the LA Times back in the late 40s. In the early 50s, and I mean, it was a big cat. He had a byline. It was like, woo. And they were a young couple. They had two little girls, my oldest sisters, and they landed this in Glendale. They got a big fancy house in Glendale up there on Mountain Street, and my mom was happy. She was, you know, damn, she was the mom. It was like picket fence. It was so beautiful. And then my mom told me, you know, then you came along because they were Catholic baby and they didn't plan me. And so, but we loved you, she said. But we loved you, she said. No, she didn't say that. That's what I heard. You know, I have a hearing problem. I was born with a hearing problem. I'm a musician with a hearing problem. What I love about, one of the things I love about this program is Bill Wilson was a musician. You know something? I'm reading Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers the other day, and they said that really Dr. Bob's house was like the early hippie settlement. They were so broke, and the door was always open for drunks to come in and out of their house. And they say on any afternoon you could find like Clarence S. trying to fix something that was broken, and Bill on the floor playing his violin. And turns out Dr. Bob loved dancing to this song called The Japanese Jitterbug. I mean, how cool is that? You know, I was right at home when I did finally wake up in here. Anyway, I'll get back to my family. So here's my mom and sisters and my dad living this Norman Rockwell dream. And I came along, and my mom tells me, you know, that they didn't plan for me. And she says, and we were hoping for a boy. But she didn't say it like that. That's what I heard. She just told me that, you know. And my dad, she said, my dad loved me. My dad loved me so much. He said he would come home from work and run around the house and throw you on his shoulders, run around the house. He said, you were the laughingest baby. You were the laughingest baby. And in 1951, on May 17th, my dad died on the kitchen floor one morning. And I was toddling around his head, and the last words he ever heard were me saying, that's a daddy. That's a daddy. And so that became like a defining aspect of my life, and I got drunk a lot over that. That was a big problem for me. It was a huge, unsolvable resentment. Kind of interesting to have a resentment like that, you know, and shaking my fist at God, you know, why me and poor me and all that stuff. My mom sold that big house and moved into a little house on Glen Hill Avenue and bought a duplex, put all the little girls on one side of the duplex and rented out the other one, and she raised us. She raised us to the best of her ability, Catholic and Catholic school and all that. And inside of me, there was always a lot of mixed up feelings, a lot of shame, a lot of feeling like it was, you see, that self-centeredness is the root of every one of my troubles. I promise you, everything that I reveal to you, you'll find it right there, that self-centeredness. You know, that self-centeredness. So I thought it was all my fault. I carried into AA the feeling that I'd killed my dad. Isn't that something? That was a lot. And I worked so hard to cheer my mom up, and that's why the music saved me, because when I listened to that music, when I remember like, I was like a tyke, man, I was five. And I heard this music, I heard Pat Boone's Love Letters in the Sand. On a day like today, man, I just, oh, on a day like today, I'm 5 years old, and I start singing it, and I got the joy and the relief, and that was something that would cheer my mom up, I thought. That redeemed me. Music redeemed me. Went through Catholic school. I'm singing. I'm trying to get good grades and be a good kid. But I have all these things inside of me. I want to know about my dad. I want to ask questions. I want to find out about it. I want to find out why it's my fault. I have all these feelings, and I can't do anything with them. I don't even know I don't even have the clarity of what I just said then. It's just feelings. But they're not good feelings, and they're guilty feelings and shameful feelings, and they start to pile up and pile up. And my sisters were cute, and they're dating boys, and they're older than me, and I'm just sitting around feeling very uncute. I was geeky, and I was tall, and I had crooked teeth, and I had a bad complexion, and I was funny looking. I had I had ears that stuck out like file folders. They did. It just like. And then Dumbo was coming out, you know, it was like very unkind. And well, my mom got my ears fixed. I was one of the first children to ever have plastic surgery. And so that was nice, you know. But they won't move now, too. They're really back there. See, we're people of extremes, aren't we? Just like all or nothing. So anyway, but all these feelings inside me and the isolation that, you know, how we're different. I lived that from that is the longest, oldest memory that I'm different. That somehow or other I'm over here and all of you are over there forever. And that's about one of my oldest feelings. So anyway, I went on a train trip with my mom and got molested by a stranger on that train, and I could never tell anybody. I could never tell my mom, and it was my fault. I was sure of it. I was 12 years old. So I'm building up all this stuff, and it's like my Al-Anon friend told me once. She said, just build it up, and you build it up, and you build it up, and then one more little thing comes in here, and you go, boom. And that was how I got to drinking. Just one more little thing. I was tired of being good. Stuff was happening. Nobody was answering my questions. I always felt restless, irritable, and discontent. And I got to be 13 years old, and I said, to heck with it. And I started to run around with all the other gangsters in Catholic school. And they thought I was funny. And they taught me about boys. Wow. And I was getting a little fascination with boys because it was time for that, right? And we bought movie magazines, and we started smoking cigarettes. We had a little clubhouse in the backyard. And one morning on the way to school, we stole some vodka from my best friend's mom. And we took it into that little cement lavatory, grade school lavatory. And I had my first drink. And it was great. It did what our first drink does. It gives us that release. You know, Bill and Bob write a lot about that release from care and worry. And you can even be really worried when you're 13, like I was. And that booze gave me that release. And it was wonderful, just wonderful. And the bell rang, we back to religion class, and I turned my will and my life over to what alcohol did. I had a new religion, you know. And I have a funny story, just a little aside, you know, because everything will catch up eventually. Everything finds you. I was speaking in Santa Clarita a few months ago, and after the meeting, this big old guy comes up to me. He's got gray hair, and he looks at me and he says, you're going to want to make amends to me when I tell you who I am. So I was trying to be gracious, you know, what do you say? And so he told me the story. And that girl that we stole some vodka from her mom for that first drink, he was her little brother. And what we used, I said, what did we do to you? And he said, you used to tape my ears back with scotch tape and tickle me till I peed. So I said, I'm sorry. And do you want me to buy you some scotch tape? You know, I guess I had a thing about ears. I don't know. It was just, Tammy said it, I think, this weekend. I thought in the end I never hurt anybody because I have that memory of convenience, you know, that you bring out when you look at that ninth step. And I had that memory of convenience. And so here was somebody all those years later, and that was a big problem for him, you know. But because of our tools and our recovery and our ability to work that through, you know, I have a new friend today. And anyway, it was funny. So I had that first drink. Then I was in public school after that, and I'm working on my image. And you know, it's the mid '60s, and I'm just love the mid '60s. I do, and I'm just stuck there. I think I check in and out. Oh, it's the new century. Oh, it's nice. Back to the '60s, but I bought it. You know, I'm the kind of person who buys stuff, you know, once I get interested. And that was worked for me in AA, and I bought the '60s. I discovered boys, and we started drinking, and I wore a lot of makeup, and I was truant from school. I became a thief. I used to steal because the world owed me a living and so on. I got asked out on a double date once. And I tell you, I wasn't in high school very often, but the captain of the football team, who's a very handsome prince of a captain, he asked me out with him. And it was a double date to the drive-in. I thought, why is he asking me out? So we got there, and he showed me his innermost self. And I was terrified. Because, you see, I'm always a little girl in the cement lavatory in the bathroom before I take that drink. You know, I'm always that way, and I was terrified. And I grew up with all these quiet, non-talkative Irish Catholic women. There's pain in the house all the time, and I'm in this situation, and I have to be cool. Any image of myself, no matter how grotesque, had power over me, believe me. And so I had to be cool. So I said, well, just a minute. I said, before we get any further along here, give me that. And I pointed at the tequila bottle that was this tall. And it was for all four of us. And I took that tequila bottle and I knocked the whole thing back. And then the next scene cut to, I'm being dumped on my mother's back porch and the Woody is speeding off into the night. And my mother drags me inside and calls the doctor. And it's like, I don't know, 64 or something like that. And the doctor says, I can't help you. She's dying from alcohol poisoning. And, you know, we had people die from alcohol poisoning in the news just a couple months ago. He says, but I'll stay on the phone with you while you give her coffee enemas.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
I really like coffee too. You know, I think sometimes if she just offered me a cup, I'd have sat up. You know. Anyway, I didn't die. And, yet. But here's why I told you that story. Because the next day, when I came to, the next day, not one word was ever, did a guitar fall? Oh, okay. I'm sorry. We always stop for a guitar falling. You have to. My name is Nancy. I'm an alcoholic. Anyway, so the next day, nothing was said about this, which is what we talk about around here. This is a family illness, and my mother was sickened by my drinking, too. And possibly some other family members. So the whole family is kind of sick, and not one word was ever shared about that night. And I went on and just bumped through high school, and I discovered the coffee houses in Hollywood, which were fantastic. You know, back in the 60s, they were not Starbucks. You know, they were joints. They were tiny joints as big as this table. And we're all stuck in there, and they were smoky, and I stuck to all the furniture. But the music was so amazing in the 60s because all that we know now that's so easy for us was being sculpted, was being born. You know, it was all new. And so it was exciting. We were just hanging around these coffee houses singing, Puff, the Magic Dragon, burning it up in killer stuff. And I loved it. I loved the rebellion of the 60s. Oh, my God, just the protest. You know, you just open the door any day and you lean out and listen carefully. You'll hear someone out there going, no. And I just love that. No. And I'd run be with them and go, no, no. And I just love being mad. And I didn't really know what was going on, but I loved that being mad. And I finally took a class on the 60s in 1987. So I got to catch up, you know, on my lost decade. It's a great decade because there's lots of writing about it, so you can catch up and fill in the blanks. So anyway, that was it. What happened to me then was God threw me this great blessing, and I met this band, and they were amazing. And in the 60s, it was like the Beach Boys, and then they went away and surfing, and the Beatles came in, and the Birds were 8 miles high, and it was just this magical three-guitar thing. But this band that I met was they were amazing. There were 26 of them. They played everything. They played the bongos, and they had an electric piano and a flute and a violin. They had a cello. Hippies had never seen a cello. It was just unbelievable what they did. And they were like, they were multicultural before that word was invented. You know, they were so excruciatingly hip. I just loved them. And they played this jam. And it was just breathtaking. And I just heard I don't know. I just heard Motherless Child in their jam. GC, GC. I just heard it. And I started singing Motherless Child with them. And we found each other. And we just did that forever. Remember the days of doing that forever? It's just wonderful. And so they were called Jay Walker and the Pedestrians. And there was... It was a big, big group, though. These are real musicians up here, so they know it was, we only had one gig because it was so hard to stop and start, you know. And just everybody was arguing about keys and rhythm patterns. And so we had a gig, but eight of us broke away from Jay Walker, and I graduated high school, got a little scholarship to the California Institute of the Arts and Music that meant nothing to me, absolutely nothing to me, because I wanted to live this life of the artist and the musician and the creative. I was right there with this pack, and eight of us broke away from Jay Walker, and we set up in a little house in Silver Lake, and we became a rock and roll band. And I was one of the first five women to sing lead in a rock band ever, because musicians used to say, you women can't sing rock. So, but I don't have any resentment. So anyway, and you'll know that's true when I stop making that point, huh? But, it was a lot of fun, and there were only four other women doing it then, and we were, you know, we were called Sweetwater, and we... You know, we pared down to seven or eight people, depending on how things were going. And we flew all over the country. We played all the rock rooms everywhere. And we played all the festivals. I remember our manager, we had a funny manager. His name, he called his business Shady Management. We used to, you know, airplane security was so different then because, you know, we used to fly, we had a 32-year-old conga player. We used to fly him on a child's half fare ticket. And in order to do that, actually, we flew a lot of us on that. In order to do that, we would get there 5 minutes before the plane left and run through the airport and run on the airplane. They shut the door. Can you imagine? I mean, that's so different. Anyway, we flew around the country. What happened inside of me is I felt this vindication. I proved to everybody who'd ever been mean to me, you missed out, you know, I'm the rock star. That was one feeling. Another feeling that I had at the same time, I was terrified you'd find out I was no good. I killed my dad. I was so afraid you'd find out I was so bad I'd killed my dad. So I'm singing my heart out on the one hand, and I've got this thing in the other hand, and drinking makes it all okay. Drinking just, it's all gone. I get release from that care. And so... we played all over the country. We were the first band to take the stage at Woodstock. And 4 months after Woodstock, 3 days after we had taped the Red Skelton Show, which was early MTV, and I was on my way to see a Steve Allen show that we had taped, I was hit by a drunk driver, and my life changed forever. One more time. And my head, I made a crater in the shape of my head in the roof of that Buick Steel. And I went spinning across that freeway, and this nothing happened to the guy. Nothing happened to my girlfriend. And they took me to Glendale Memorial Hospital on the one night of the month when all the neurologists of Southern California are having a meeting. The finest head doctors, the cream of the crop, were having their regular monthly meeting that night. And they came down to the emergency room, and they worked on me, and they said, this girl will not live. No one can survive a blow like that. But, you know, cheer up. Check it out, man. I think they're all dead. You and I know there's a power greater than all the finest neurologists of Southern California. He's in the room right now. She's in the room right now, right next to you. Look at your neighbor. There you go. There you go. They told me that. My home group when I got sober was 4343 Radford. My home group today is the Easy Does It group at the Windsor Club Wednesday night. You know. And I have a sponsor who's 40 years sober. Her name is Millie, and she has a sponsor who's 45 years sober who has a sponsor. So I'm in this deal now. This is like my commitment, my life. Anyway, I came out of this coma. Surprised everybody. They said, well, if she comes out, she'll be a vegetable. Well, I came out, and I knew who Tricky Dick was, and I could add 13 and 4, and I had brain damage. That was the past tense. So, you know, I've always wanted to do something, but no, it's... I had brain damage, and I permanently lost the use of one of my vocal cords. You couldn't have taken anything more precious from me. That was my whole life. It was so horrible that until I got sober, I didn't deal with it because I couldn't deal with it then. I had 6 operations on my throat. I got out of the hospital in 2 months. I worked on my voice with a doctor and a coach, and I eventually got a new style back. I got the one cord to do the work of two. They would say jokingly, oh, she sings chords now. But these guys know. And but that was it for me because I had to do that. What else would I do? I was worth nothing without that. And so the band broke up. They were young too, and they were fractured too, and nobody had tools and skills, and you know, everybody has. Everybody, you know, in the world limps along in some way. But we broke up, and they were devastated. And I went on my own for a while. But that, boy, that alcoholism doesn't care. Boy, does it? Doesn't care about what happened to you, how sorry it is, or your sex, or your money, or your gender. It just doesn't care, does it? Just find you if you've got it, and that's it. And I was drinking hard. You know, that neurologist said you should never drink. And I said, what does that guy know? And I went to drinking and drinking and drinking and trying to find my way through Hollywood, and I was never that good at it. Trust me, I'm a terrible business person. It's like if you play poker with me and I get a good hand, I go, oh, you know, and everybody quits. So, you know. All of my good fortune has been because of God, you know, all of it, every bit of it, I guarantee you. Drinking and sober. Eventually, it just was terrible. And I had a new record deal, and the record company went belly up, and I was on my own again. And I got a secretary because she drank like me. I didn't have any business. Nobody wanted me playing with them. I was a mess. I was struggling to remember a C chord on the piano, which is very, very simple, as some of you know. It's very simple. Boom. And I was struggling with everything. And that's why I say my drinking cut away that music. I stopped dreaming. I stopped believing. I wanted just, I don't know what I wanted. I can't remember wanting. Maybe just to get up and somehow I started living in tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to clean this place up. Tomorrow I'm going to make that phone call. Tomorrow I'm going to pay those bills. Tomorrow I'm going to, you know, go have lunch with somebody. Tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow. I'm living in tomorrow. And I always felt like I was going to do it. But I always got drunk every single time. The secretary that I got went to AA. Oh, God, I fired her, you know. And but she was going to AA and loved AA, and she thought the people were so nice, and she didn't drink anymore, but she smoked pot and took Quaaludes. And she 12-stepped me. She saw me at a Hollywood soiree one Sunday afternoon, and my only life was so simple. I just didn't want to fall down while the sun was up. I'm just drinking this wine, trying not to fall down while the sun was up. And she looked at me over a joint and said, you got to try AA. And she added, it's heavy, you know. So, but I didn't want that, man. I told you, I looked at my box of dope, and I knew that that was my problem, and I just wanted to drink. I wanted to get back to that release. I was looking for that release from care and fear and worry. And I was, you know, and throwing a few laughs, too, please. How cool would that be? But it was gone. And that was what they told me when I got here. It's gone. If you have this allergy of alcoholism, it's gone. It won't be back. And I believed. And that is something I thank you with all my heart for. I believed you. It's gone. And I saw in my sobriety the ones who would try to drink like that again. And they die and they go crazy. And that's what Dr. Bob said. Those are what's left for you and me. Insanity or death or prison. You know, insanity, death, or prison. So anyway, I started off telling you about Joe, and I got here. You know, before I move on, I do want you to know that Secretary of Mine is sober and clean, and I have more time than her. But she's not that matters. But we only have today. But you know, she's a wonderful member of this program. Her name is Linda M. But anyway, I got into this deal finally that day in my bikini, and I stumbled into a life that is beyond anything I ever imagined. And it takes a long time. It takes a long time for an alcoholic like me, who thinks she knows everything, who looks down her nose at people when she's scared and doesn't even know she's scared. And I was like that. I was very patronizing to you. You were so corny, you know, really. And all those teeth and the smiles around here was just terrible. And you were not cool. And you spoke in sentences, and you had this language like gratitude and anonymity. But you know, as I just brought the body to meetings, the miracle happened. The theme of this convention, the miracle happened. And it happened to me. And now I'm charged with always giving it back wherever I can, whenever I'm asked. You know, you've heard that kind of sobriety this weekend, and I so admire that in the people who shared. Whenever asked, that hand of AA has to be there, because it was so for me. The people who listened to me and loved me and wanted me there, and they wanted to know who I am. You know, in the big book, well, I love the big book, but there's a lot of books to read in AA. In the big book, in working with others, it says find out as much as you can about your man first. You know, and I forget to do that. My ego gets out in front, and I think I have to tell my story, you know. But maybe I need to get to know that person a little bit more, like Joe did with me, you know, because those are the instructions out of that chapter when working with others. Get to know your person. And so those were the kinds of things that I was beginning to learn. And I would hear these guys at 4343 Radford, they said the most amazing things. They said a grateful thought could be a perfect prayer. Imagine that. How easy is that? And so I came back and I learned to pray. I learned to pray. I learned that mechanical prayers work. Even that if I would just take the action, and that something good would come. My bad luck became my good luck. That's what happens around here. Your bad luck becomes your good luck. Your defects become your assets, you know. But it takes a long time. That first year of mine got to be a lot of fun. It got to be a lot of fun because I stumbled into the greatest secret of all. It's not a secret, it's an open secret, the 12th step. And it happened, you know, I like to talk, I'm a broken performer, now I had a built-in stage everywhere I went, I had a stage, and I was so important, you know, narcissism is a part of the deal here too, right? So I was so important, I always had to share my daily revelations everywhere. And you know what, it kept me here. It kept me here. Until I learned about the quiet, till I learned that I was safe here. You know, sometimes when people talk too much, it's because they don't think they're safe. But I learned that I was safe here. About 6 months of sobriety, somebody asked me to sponsor her. Whoa! I had a title in AA. 6 months and a title. That is a rocket to stardom, isn't it? Shows you how smart I am. How well, she was a pillhead, and she had me running errands for her, but she got me into the literature because I was worried about my image. Do you see, your defect becomes an asset? But it's contingent on not drinking or using pills in between meetings or smoking gangster cigarettes. We don't do that anymore, right? And going to meetings and going to meetings and having a sponsor and believing a little bit. This lady told me once, she said, you don't have to buy it 100%. Just take 1%. You can keep your 99%, but just take my 1%. Maybe she's right. She was talking to me one day about God. So anyway, my first baby went away. And then 7 months of sobriety, someone else asked me to be her sponsor. Woo! And we drove around. We drove all over Southern California. I love the stories this weekend about Hermosa Beach and Manhattan Beach. We were all over Southern California going to figure this disease out. We were Bill and Bob together. And we were, because this girl wanted it too. You know, somebody said once, the AA is not for people who need it. It's not for people who want it. It's for people who get it. There's something here that's very special that is endlessly. You can mine it endlessly. Didn't we hear that this morning in the old-timers meeting? These old-timers are saying more is revealed. With 48 years, more is revealed. Yes, that's what I want. I want to have 48 years of sobriety. I want to have 50 years. I want them to have to carry my cake. Seventy-seven years of sobriety. I'm gonna make it, because I get it. And so we were driving around with 7 months of sobriety in 1 minute, her in the car, and that was so great. That made me feel so connected to you. Unity, recovery, service. And I answered her phone calls, and we worked her steps. I gave her a 30-year tip 3 years ago. Wow! That, well, see, she got away from me. She went somewhere else, but she came back and gave her a 30-year tip. And but, you know, I am, my cup runneth over, as the saying goes, with what we do here. And, you know, these are beautiful moments together, beautiful weekends, Memorial Weekend. What do we remember? All the ones that went before us. Jack Kissel. All the ones that went before us. You know, when I saw Gene the other night, there was hope right across the stage, wasn't it? Hope right across the stage, which is the one thing I've found in every single AA meeting. Hope. Hope for me, hope for you, and us. And us. You know, it's amazing. Anyway, I get a little excited. I had to go through these steps. Of course, we all go through these steps if we're going to stay sober. And it was an amazing journey. There are promises after the fifth step to keep you going. And one of them is that we can look the world in the eye after we've read that fifth step. We can look the world in the eye. And we feel that we're on the road to recovery. You know, and the six and seven steps, and then eight and nine. And by the time we get through that ninth step, we are amazed before we're halfway through. It's all true, and it all keeps happening. Like I say, I apparently am not done with my ninth step, am I? I got to buy that guy Scotch tape. But I don't mind. I don't mind at all. I welcome these things today, and I'm grateful for them. I got busy in AA. I was so active. I didn't work. I spent my rock and roll money on this life, and I institutionalized myself in AA, and I met him. He had blonde hair and blue eyes, and we had a year of sobriety, so we went roller skating. You know when you go roller skating for the first time in a long time and you do this when you first get on your skates? He did that, and he looked at me, and he said, "You're not going to hold on to me, are you?" Oh, my God. I said, "No," and I thought, "I love you." And the next day, we moved in together. We had a year of sobriety, man. We moved, we packed up our bags. We moved from 4343 Radford to Laguna Beach in 1978. And we lived down there, and we didn't get particularly any closer. We spent my rock and roll money, and we woke up one day, we said, "We're not getting along." And then we said, "Let's get married." Believe me, I was doing the best I could. But I wasn't. I didn't call my sponsor. You know who we called? There was a guy who advertised in the Penny Saver called Reverend Wright. His ad read, "Marry today, call Reverend Wright now." So you don't call your sponsor, you call Marry today, Reverend Wright now. He married us in a little office, in a little dusty office in Tustin with a plastic fern in the corner, and he had mustard on his tie. And he was placing bets before, you know, the money. I mean, it's just comic, you know. But any image of myself, no matter how grotesque, had power over me. And if I was a miss of somebody, maybe you'd never find out I killed my dad. You'd never find out I wasn't any good. I walked away from music. Now I thought, if I'm just a good woman, if I'm just somebody's good woman. But the marriage fell apart. My husband went back out. And the marriage fell apart, and I started cleaning houses in Laguna Beach. And I wasn't a very good house cleaner, and I went back to college for money. and the miracle happened. You see, there he did it again. He took a defect, turned it into an asset. Phony old 5 years sober, back to college for money, and boom, it became an asset. Because I loved college. I loved learning. I was amazed. I was amazed. I thought I knew it all. I knew nothing. And now you had taught me that truth about me. And so I got in my classes and, oh my God, it was so beautiful. And I had these beautiful teachers. And my English teacher liked me. And I tutored. I got to be a tutor. Geez, I'm a tutor. I don't have to say I'm an alcoholic. I say, "Hi, I'm Nancy. I'm your tutor." I'm a tutor. And my first student was this nun from Vietnam. Gee, she was beautiful. She had a big forehead, too. Really smart, really connected to God. See, and I just loved her, and she just beamed looking at me across the table. "Hi, I'm Nancy. I'm your tutor." And she beamed. I said, "Man, I have something." So I love college, and I love learning. You all went to college with me. Man, everybody at the Candy Club, we went to college together. I'd come in, I'd tell you all the stuff I learned, and you helped me. God, this guy helped me. Once I had the quantum physics. Oh, no. I'm a musician who can't get quantum physics. You know, some of you, that Schrodinger cat? Schrodinger cat, if you look in the box, you see a cat, he's in the box. If you look away, he's not in the box. You can't figure that out. And so I had... But I got help in the meeting. This guy sat with me in the half measures room. He got me to figure out what the cat's doing, where the cat went. And we passed. We got B's, we got A's. We talked about Canterbury Tales. The guy behind the coffee bar was Jesuit educated and needed somebody to talk about those old Canterbury Tales to. And we just sit there and talk about the Canterbury Tales. You know what happened to me? Well, I became a teacher. I became a college teacher 21 years ago by the grace of God and with all your love. Because I run my classroom like a meeting, kind of. Everybody shares. A good friend of mine is here right now, and he's in my classes, and he knows what I'm talking about. And it's because of you guys. It's because of love. You taught me to go to the room where the crazy person is and find out as much as you can about them, and then you give them the miracle. You stay. You don't run when things get tough. You stay. I never knew that. And this year I found out about my dad. And I found out about my dad through the compassion and the love of this program. It came to me like in a dream. I was doing some 10-step inventory. And you know, I've had this thing my whole life. I'm 60 years old, and I've had this thing my whole life. Where's my dad? And of course it turned into, "You're mean, Dad. You left me." Which translates to other people. And I'm doing this 10-step writing, and all of a sudden I had a moment of grace when I imagined what my dad's death was like. What was it like for my daddy to lay on the floor in those seconds and know that he was leaving all of us and his beautiful life, going to the next place? And my heart changed. And I felt such compassion. It was a big deal to me. And that's what we see in our literature, isn't it? Bill says, oh, the guy fell out of the bed. We don't know. I think it was Bill. Fell out of the bed and said he had a change of heart. He didn't have a change of mind. He had a change of heart. And that was always it for me with you guys in every meeting. Isn't it true? The minute somebody speaks from their heart, we all hear that. You know? It's where we live. Bill says, you know what? We have these fancy meetings and we have equipment and, you know, Coke machines and coffee pots and amplifiers and stages and fancy microphones. All two alcoholics need is a curb. Sit down and tell me about it. And one of my favorite things, I know I'm talking too long, I can feel it. There's a vibration now. So I want to close with my favorite thing, and that is what Snow in Florida wrote in the grapevine a few months ago. I just love it. She said, no matter who you are, no matter what you believe about God or don't believe about God, no matter how broken your glasses are or your heart is, God can find you in AA. In fact, he already has. Thank you.
Outstanding. One more time. Yeah.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.